meeting to order. Could we start with the roll call?
Francine Aquin.
Here.
Samantha Bloom.
Here.
Nicholas Brennan. David Brown. Tyler Dixon.
David is there.
David's on Zoom.
Oh.
He's in Zoom.
Okay. Tyler Dixon. Catherine Farrell.
I think
Lise Forcier.
Oh, yeah.
Andy Garcia-Ortiz.
Here.
Elizabeth Gatz.
Here.
Dinesh Kumar.
Here.
Kedrick Winsky. Bridget Ayes. Michelle Keeney.
Here.
Kazar Joffrey.
Here.
Srikant Karaikal.
Yeah.
Sawad Ocean Karim.
That's good. Wait for a sec. Here.
not crossed out on this one. Anurag Quayada.
Yeah.
Abel Agressa.
Here.
Jesse Lopez.
Here.
Xander Lynch.
Here.
Salman Matan.
Here.
Annika McGraw. Drew Parekh. Bhavin Patel. Baswati Sharma. Seam Set.
Here.
Georgia Smits.
Here.
Rajvi Thakur.
Here.
V. Rie.
I am also here. great. How many people
do we have? That's 21.
Great.
And I was wrong. Katie is not here.
Daryl. Okay. That's still okay. All right. Are there any late additions to the agenda? Anyway. Jessica has just pulled up the attendance QR code for anyone who is representing an organization or a field or anything like that. You can use that to sign in instead of going onto the Zoom. So that's exciting. We'll keep that there for a minute or two. Okay, if there are no late additions, we'll move on to approval of the March 11th meeting minutes. Is everyone done with the QR code?
No.
Now we'll go to March 11th.
Oh, go back one sec for Ocean.
Oh,
the QR code.
Uh-oh, sorry.
Hold on, it's not working.
Should be a normal though, Lynn.
Right
now.
Okay. Everyone good to move away from the QR code?
What are you doing with this?
Oh.
What did you say?
This is just the attendance if you're representing a club or. Yeah, you're representing a club. Not everyone has.
Is it view only?
Oh, yeah, looks like it's view only.
Well, now.
I think maybe refresh it. I think you just changed it.
Okay.
Are you here in the capacity?
Not really. No.
So, minutes?
Yes. We're just going to pull up the minutes from the last meeting and quickly go through them. And if no one sees any changes that need to be done, we'll approve them.
So this is March 11.
It also is in boxes for people that are on their devices.
Okay, there any changes or questions to the meeting minutes that they're presented? Are there any objections to unanimously approving the March 11th meeting minutes? All right, they are approved. Thanks, everyone. All right, now we're moving on to introducing business of the day.
Do you want February 5th minutes, too?
We didn't have that on the agenda.
Oh, are we ready?
No.
No.
So we'll get to that later. Okay, so for the business of the day, we have Resolution 6, which is from Member Lynch, looking at the SIFC guidelines amendment that we talked about for many meetings. We also have a discussion from Michelle on University Assembly response to the interim expected activity policy, and we will talk about those in the breakout sessions. But first, we have a presentation today from the Ombuds Office. Bruce Lewinstein is here to tell us about what the Ombuds Office does and what availability it has for graduate professional students. So, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the invitation to be here. I'm Bruce Lewinstein. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Communication and in the Department of Science and Technology Studies, so both public and private sides of the university, and I'm half-time on the university ombuds. And I appreciate being here today. I'm sitting here. I know the people on Zoom. I'm just a tiny little head at the end of the table, but at least I'm sort of facing. So what I want to do today is give you a brief introduction to the Ombuds Office, how we work, who we are, what kinds of things we can help with. We'll give you a little bit of data about our last complete year, which was the 2022-2023 year, and then answer any questions that you have. The office was established in 1969, or after the events of 1969. It started in 1970. So we've been here for over 50 years and we serve faculty, staff, and students across all of the Ithaca campuses except for the medical school. So we don't cover the medical school. Next slide, please. There are three of us in the office. As I said, I'm a faculty member. I've been here for more than 35 years. I've had a lot of experience in university governance. I've been a department chair, part of faculty senate. My colleague, Linda Paulson, who's the associate ombuds, is a Cornell alum, grew up in Ithaca, and has worked at the university for about 25 years. She's been in the office for about 15. And then we have our newest member, Apia Alapur, joined us last year. She has a lot of expertise in dispute resolution. I put this up here to highlight two things. One, we bring both knowledge of Cornell and Ithaca to the table, but we also bring with the new to Cornell experience, which is part of what sometimes brings people to the office. Next slide, please. You can, by the way, you can meet with us. People can meet with us by phone, by Zoom, video, or in person as people prefer. We operate by four key principles, which are the principles of the international ombuds profession. The first and most important is confidentiality. So when you come to the office, the very fact that you've contacted the office remains confidential. We may talk among ourselves within the office, but your having come to the office remains confidential. There are two exceptions. If we thought there was imminent risk of serious harm to someone, we would have to take action. And two, there are certain unusual legal situations where if they were to come up, we would talk about how to handle confidentiality. How do we protect confidentiality? We don't keep records, so there's nothing you can get from us. We do not accept formal notice for the university. And we do take notes when we're talking to you, but we get rid of the notes when we're done. If I meet somebody on campus who I know primarily because they've come to the ombuds office, I wouldn't acknowledge knowing them because I wouldn't want somebody with them to say, well, how do you know the ombuds? So we try to avoid that as much as we can. The The other three principles support confidentiality. We are independent of any other unit on campus. We get our budget from the president's office, but I don't report to the president in a hierarchical way. I report to the community through the UA, the University of San Diego. We are informal. We're not part of any formal appeals or grievance processes. We help identify them. We help talk people through what their options are, what the pros and cons of various approaches might be. But we ourselves are not in the room. We're not decision makers. And that's tied to the final principle, which is that we're impartial. We don't take sides. Again, our job is to help identify options and help people think about what their choices are. These four principles were essentially identified in the original memo establishing the office, which was written by then Arts and Sciences College Dean Dr. Khan. We've updated our memo, several times, mostly charter, most recently a couple of years ago. The International Ombuds Association came along just about 20 years ago. We were way ahead of in terms of these principles. So we've done. Next slide, please. Where can we help? This is the most important. We can help with anything involving your work or your life at Cornell, studies at Cornell. We're a place to turn when you're just not sure where else to turn. I'm not sure which office to go to. You're not even sure exactly whether you have a problem and you want someone to just talk through a challenge and think about what it is. So covering student, staff, and faculty, this can be about job classifications, it can be about workplace, or lab, climate, or culture, research group, it can be about supervisory relationships, both work relationships and then advising relationships for graduate students, professional students, changing roles and expectations. Any kind of ethical issue or concern can come to the office. Harassment or bullying, when people aren't sure how to think about it, where to go, we can talk about anything that someone perceives as unfair. We talk through what some of the options are. We do handle some interpersonal conflicts. It's not our major area, but if you're not sure where to turn, come to us and we'll talk about what options are. If you want to work through, you have a difficult conversation coming up with an employer or with an advisor, we can help role model and role play discussions and think about tools of conflict resolution that you can help work get through them. And we help with just understanding university policies. Which policies might be relevant? Where does your concern fall within the policy system? Next slide, please. So what do? The first thing we do is we listen. We welcome you, everybody on campus, to come, and we practice active listening. I'll show you later, we don't have great measures of effectiveness, but one of the things we have is a lot of people, the number of people who say to us, "I felt heard," tells us that that's something that we offer. As I said, we can then provide information about relevant policies, we can provide information about which office to go to resolve an issue, to let the university know the problem. We spend a lot of time helping people think about their options in a particular situation, refer you to the offices. We do some facilitated conversations where we can be the third person in the room helping two people have a conversation. It's not our primary area. It's not an area that we've done extensively. But we're building that capability. It's one of the things that T brought to the office when she came last year, with expertise there. And then we have a more systemic function, which is that as we hear issues, if we see patterns or particular concerns, we have the ability to provide feedback to the administration about recurring patterns or issues that we see emerging or where we think there's some kind of systemic issue or trend. Next slide, please. What we don't do, we don't take sides. We're not an advocate, except in general for fairness and dignity. And also, we don't provide legal advice. both Linda and Ati have legal degrees, but neither one, well, actually that's not true. Ati still does a little bit of legal practice on the side, but that's on a whole separate part of her life. Linda usually refers to herself as she used to be, but she is still legal. But we don't provide legal. Next slide, please. So a little bit of a report about the last full year that we have data for. Generally, we see about a third of our visitors are staff, usually up to a third are faculty, both tenure track and RTE faculty, and then between a third and a half are students, split about evenly between undergrads and grad professionals. So in this last full year, we were actually a little heavy on the student side. About 25% were graduate or professional students. We see on average between 300 and 400 visitors a year. Any one visitor might be anything from a 10-minute phone call to multiple in-person visits for several months, even a year. Someone might come back on the same issue. So we've got that full range. Next slide, please. In terms of the issues that we see, the largest single category is employment. That's not just staff, that includes students where there are employment issues. About another quarter or so are academic actions, committee decisions, conflicts with advisors, things like that. And then the rest are split between interpersonal issues, various kinds of administrative disputes, some values and ethics, kinds of issues, harassment, bias come up as well. I generally say that we do everything from a freshman who's having a dispute with the housing office, and as an 18-year-old, they've never learned how to deal with a bureaucracy before. They just need help. Yes, sorry.
What does employment mean?
Oh, so employment are often relationships with supervisors. It's often a conflict with a supervisor. So maybe a discipline, grievance procedure, might be someone whose duties have changed and the employee and the supervisor are having trouble working out how to rearrange the workload around those. Sometimes this has to do with accommodation for disabilities. And disagreements about how to handle that. It's a whole range of stuff. So that's the sort of middle ground, the bureaucratic stuff, these various kinds of conflicts, all the way to people, students, staff, and faculty who are being told it's time for you to leave the university now. And those people are not in our office sometimes. So it's a full range of stuff. Next slide, please. So some specific examples of things that we can do. So conversations about disability accommodations come up. It's a fairly regularized system for undergraduates. The system is the same for graduate students, but there are different kinds of accommodations that are needed for graduate and professional students. So sometimes that comes up. We get a lot of mentoring questions. I work actually closely with the graduate school on mentoring issues. I talk frequently with people in graduate school who are helpful. So mentoring issues, advising issues, conflicts with advisors, people who want to change advisors, but they're not sure how to go about doing it in a way that preserves their relationships, disagreements about the directions of research and how to handle that conversation, and so on. Traditionally, we have done some work with graduate student funding and worth issues, particularly when it's an RA, straight RA kind of position that isn't directly related to a student's thesis work. This was obviously before the union vote. We are still, like everybody else, learning exactly how this changes the way that some of these discussions will happen. We continue again to try to work as constructively as we can to work on that. We are in touch with ombuds offices at other universities to understand how they're working with their student unions, graduate student unions as well. Academic integrity issues. This comes up in the graduate context often in terms of questions about authorship, sometimes about plagiarism, but sometimes about questions about data integrity. So next slide, please. Looking ahead for the Ombuds Office, so I've been in the position for about 2 years, so I finished one full academic cycle. I came in the middle of the year. And so as we look ahead and thinking about what we want to do, we have to figure out how to assess our success. I can give you numbers. It's harder for me to tell you exactly what we've achieved. As I said, we hear people say they feel heard. I can point occasionally to a major conflict that I think we diffused before it became a big conflict. But those are hard to point to, especially because we protect confidentiality. I can't tell you about this. Right? We're doing a lot more outreach and engagement. My coming here is part of that. I'm trying to speak to all the assemblies. I would be glad for you as you go back and talk to your groups. I'm glad to come talk to any group on campus that would like to hear more about what you do and how we can help them. We get involved with training and conflict resolution. We do some of it. The Scheinman Institute in ILR does conflict resolution trainings. They also work closely with the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards. The Human Resources Department of Organizational Development and Effectiveness also does a lot of trainings, usually not directly with graduate and professional students, but sometimes there are departmental-wide issues that they can help with. And there are some other groups on campus with commission. And then, as I said, we're building this capability for facilitated conversations. And so next slide is the thank you very much. Forgot to say how to contact us. You can stop by the office in person. We are not, we're a hybrid office, so there isn't always someone there, but we're trying to be sure there's someone there at least part of the day, most days. You can send us an email to ombuds@cornell.edu. You can call us. We have the best phone number on campus, 54321. I'm glad to take any questions.
Yeah, how'd you become an ombuds?
So I was the student ombudsman at my undergraduate institution, which I happened because one of my professors said, hey, I think there's this job you might want. At that institution, we served only students. It was a student who served students. So unlike most people, I knew what an ombudsman was. You notice I said ombudsman, and then I got to where today I'm talking about ombuds. In the intervening period, we're at an academic institution, we could have a wonderful linguistic discussion about whether ombudsman is gendered in the original Scandinavian languages. In English, it's clearly perceived as a gendered term. And so the International Ombuds Association, a few years ago, went through a multi-year process and suggested switching. So I now refer to ombuds. So because I knew what an ombuds was, I knew that Cornell had one. As it happens, I've known the two people who preceded me, both of whom were in office for about 10 or 12 years. Each, the most recent, was Charlie Walcott, who's a former dean of the faculty, still at age 89 or 90, still an active member of university governance. And so when I heard he was retiring, I thought, well, that's something I know something about. And because, I have this funny faculty position, I'm in two, both public and private sides. I was for 4 years a faculty elected member of the Board of Trustees. So I think I have an overview of the university that many people don't. And I don't like to take sides, so I like being in the middle.
A question of how you would personally handle a situation like this. So given that the Ombuds office is so small and that there might be, I think you talked about it in a sense, but
but there might be people who know each other. And the fact that the Cornell community is, you know, a small community in its own self. How would you handle, and how do your fellow OMBUDS officers handle when they might know a party involved in a dispute?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Ithaca's a small town, mm-hmm. and Cornell's a small place. And because especially Linda and I have been around for so long, especially Linda, Linda knows everybody. Linda's mother was a kindergarten teacher for my kids, mm-hmm. right? You know, this is the kind of small town we have. So if it's just that we know somebody, it's usually not an issue. But we always offer, if you would prefer to talk to somebody else in your office, welcome. I have told, because I have what in the ombuds world is called collateral duty. That is to say, I'm a faculty member. I have these other duties, I'm only half time the ombuds. I have told my departments, both faculty and students, that if they ever wish to use the ombuds office and don't want to talk to me, they should feel free to contact the other people directly. If I see a query come in from somebody in our departments, I almost always just say, why don't one of you take it? And we can sometimes move it out of our, yeah, we share the ombuds email. I say, well, maybe you should take it to your personal email so I'll be unaware of what's happened.
Well, Bruce, we have a question on Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
Do ombuds have reporting obligations regarding issues like potential Title IX infractions?
That's an excellent question, and the answer is no. The university has allowed us to be a confidential resource that we are not obligated to report something to Title IX. There's a harassment issue. And fairly often, in fact, people will come to us because they want to know what's going to happen if they go to the Title IX office. And we can talk them through the process, talk about their options, what some of their goals are. There, remember I mentioned that there are certain unusual legal situations. So this is related to employment, not to a student situation. The standard for when the university needs to be told officially that there's a hostile work environment used to be that it had to be a pervasive, that had to be sort of pervasive. A few years ago, New York State, at the direction of, ironically, then Governor Cuomo, passed a law lowering the standard for reporting. And if you are not from New York and ask your New York friends why that's ironic, he was forced out of office because of having a hostile work environment. It's now, if anybody on campus, if any employee of Cornell is aware of a hostile work environment, it must be reported. This is a new law. There's no case law. It's unclear exactly how it would affect ombuds work. We have worked with the council's office to make sure that we can continue to offer confidentiality. If the situation comes up that this we think this new law might apply, then we work with the visitor to talk about how we can handle the situation. We don't necessarily have to immediately report it. And we don't necessarily have to be the ones to. So sometimes there's other options. Yeah, Catherine.
And when you say report it to?
Who? So a hostile work environment needs to be reported to a responsible party. I don't know the exact language. To a responsible party. It's not necessarily the Title IX office, because it might not be a matter of a protected status.
Okay.
It could be a bullying situation, general. In which case a department head or dean or a dean of a graduate school or something like that would be appropriate person.
We have any other questions for Bruce before he leaves?
Thank you. I am glad to answer questions anytime. Please feel free to send us a note to ombuds@cornell.edu and reach out. And I very much appreciate the time.
All right. After- after that presentation, we will briefly discuss business of the day before going into our breakout session. First up, we are going to be talking about Resolution 6. It was printed out. People around you should have copies. So we will be talking about this and any questions, concerns, feelings on it during the breakout session. So be aware of that. And then Michelle's going to give a brief update on what she wants to discuss before the breakout session.
So Martha has requested from the University Assembly that there be a formal response to the interim expressive activity policy. And for people who aren't familiar with the interim expressive activity policy, it is the recent policy that was put out with the anti-doxing policy on, what do they call it, form, time, location, something like that, protests, really. So this policy is pretty punitive, it seems, in its nature, and not very clear. And there were some issues with both rollout and gathering feedback after it. So the University Assembly has already decided that its stance is to reject the policy and that that will be listed. And we're not giving line items of the policy. We're giving broad feedback and comments. In addition to this, I'm collecting individual comments that can either be with names attached or anonymous, if you so choose, to add to the document, because I think, you know, we as an assembly can say something and the University Assembly as an assembly can say something, but all of you are individuals and are individually impacted by this policy. And there are some people already who are going through the student code of conduct process on this policy, both grads and undergraduates, and some staff, actually. So given all of that, it would be nice if you guys could talk about it, and potentially, if you have free-form feedback, send that my way. Or if there's other ways that you could see this happening, also let me know. Really just a generalized discussion. And then in this, this kind of is slightly tied to, but I don't know if these should be distinct things. Obviously this policy has brought up a lot of feelings because of the current state of protests on campus that are mostly centered around divestment, specifically divestment from 10 weapons dealer companies. And I know Gus is bringing up a resolution about forming a joint committee with the SA on this. But through all the discussions that I've had now through the University Assembly, it seems that unanimously the assemblies do agree upon divestment from these weapons dealers. So I'm wondering if in either tied to this response to the Interim Expressive Policy Act or whatever, I said it wrong, but either tied to this or independently but parallel to this, if we could put forward as assemblies a very minimalistic, we all agree, we can all at a minimum agree on divestment from 10 weapons dealer companies and put that forward to get passed through, especially given the fact that we have so few meetings left in the year. And if that is, you know, a bare minimum consensus, then I'm okay with that bare consensus, as long as you all are too. Yeah. Discuss and enjoy.
Okay, so we will have those two topics of discussion in our breakout sessions. We're going to do random groups this time, so not by field. So just like 5 to 10 people, either who you're sitting next to or people you haven't met, whatever. We'll do random groups and we'll meet for, let's say, 10 minutes and be back at the 45 to discuss.
Now is the time to drive that comments. Campus groups is the thing that is a post. sorry.
Okay, everybody, we are going to start officially discussing Resolution 6 as a whole room at this point. Okay, would anyone like to make a comment or a question? Yes, Michelle.
Okay, Xander, I want to know if all field groups go to the highest funding possible with this resolution, how much more in the red will be?
I actually don't know that, because one of the issues is that, like, basically we weren't keeping track of who a field group was. It was just kind of like, if you, like, filled out the form and you and nobody else from, like they didn't see, like, two Spanish clubs or whatever, they were just like, yeah, you're a field group, sure, here's the money. And it was, like, such a small amount of money that, like, I don't think anyone really cared, I guess. So the part of this would also be, we have to actually, like, keep track or, like, reach out to all the departments and be like, do you have a club or an organization that you want to acknowledge as your field group for your graduate students? So I think that would be the first step in knowing that information, but I'm not sure that is necessarily should be a prerequisite of this amendment, because this amendment is about equity, not about how, like, whether this organization was previously doing a good job keeping track of what it had already defined.
I guess comment to follow up is that we are currently, with the projections, going to be, I think it was about $200 in the red if all groups pick their highest funding tier. So that is one of my largest concerns with this motion. And that's more of just your comment.
And to clarify what you said, so in terms of the current number of groups we have, if they were the highest tier based on the limits we've applied.
Limits we've applied, not including this resolution. So this resolution would open that up. And then again, because field groups aren't defined, unless we get a resolution to define those things before the end of the year, theoretically all groups could be field groups and be qualified for this, which means all groups could be qualified for the highest funding. So that is my concern.
It's not that there's no definition of what a field group is, it's just that nobody was keeping track of what that is. What we added last time was the definition referencing GPSAFC's own guidelines. And so so it's not that there's no definition, it's that GPSAFC wasn't keeping track of that because people weren't using that previous system, really. Like last year, they got 6 applications.
Yeah, exactly. It's not that we weren't following the system. It's that there wasn't that much need to cross-reference because each of the groups were pretty obviously a field group.
Yeah.
And there weren't other people in that same field also applying for funding.
Yeah.
This year, I think we've had like 9, mm-hmm. and they were all very separate. So there weren't issues of like multiple groups trying to apply for the funding from the same field. Okay, are there any other comments or questions about the resolution?
I just for clarification. So in order to be a field group in a given year, you have to apply to be a field group in the previous year?
No. So to be a field group in a given year, you apply to the field group funding, and the only thing that requires you to be, or the only thing that would remove you from the category of a field group if you applied, is if you and another organization both said you work in the same field. So theoretically, all organizations under our current system can be field groups. So long as there's like not another field group within the field.
A dance, like the swing club, is not a field group.
Yeah, and it would very obviously
this is like an academic group, so that limits.
But we don't check, is I guess my larger concern.
Yes, we do.
I mean, do we though? So,
I've approved most of the field funding things this year, and they were all from specific academic representing clubs, like the linguistics graduate student organization, or English, like, so, I don't know how much you check beyond that their name.
Yeah, matches. But there are, I know there are field groups that don't have names that are, like, specifically, I am this, like, for example, there's Synapses, which... Plant breeding?
Yep.
The plant breeding folks in the room? Okay, yeah. Synapses is the plant breeding field group for the plant breeding field, but it's not named in respect to it. So there is the possibility for this to be potentially of concern. And then I also do wonder if we add this, should we remove field group funding entirely and have that be the mechanism by which this is done? I don't know. That's more of an open-ended thought that I would want.
I guess, unfortunately, not addressing that question in particular, but in terms of having limits, I wonder for all the concerns that we've mentioned in terms of, oh, everyone can be a field group, this subset could be a field group. If we have a system where we're able to break the limits that we set, what's the point of setting the initial limits in the first place? I think one of the main issues that we have is that the limits were designed to be able to maximize the amount of money to have the most impact possible. And this is undercutting that system. And I understand that there are arguments to be had about certain organizations are more, not worthy, of course, but more capable of benefiting broader students. I don't necessarily know how we can prove that and or figure that out, whether it becomes the field group funding specifically or saying, this organization is what we think they are without additional bureaucracy and more things that aren't already there. That was coherent enough, I suppose.
People would like to move forward on this. I can entertain a motion to call the question, but if there are any other comments or changes that people would like to suggest? I can hear that now. Yes.
Would it be better to just have a different membership requirement for field groups as opposed to like removing the limit altogether instead? Like still providing some level of gap, but allowing the field groups to move to a higher level than their membership without letting them go all the way.
Yeah.
I would have to disagree with having a different scale because one, how are we even like creating the scale in the first place? Because even within field groups, some fields tend to have more members within than others. Like there's more likely going to be a lot of people in biology of a field rather than linguistics. So to have like a separate scale would still also be kind of like a really weird thing. And also then, as mentioned before, if everyone is technically a field group, then what's not to say that they use that scale instead to then make the funding more easier for them. At the same time, I feel like a lot of our discussions is also like creating the hypothetical of like, oh, if someone that's like really smart and understands how to exploit GPSA, then that's like the best thing that they can do to game the system and stuff. The possibility is there, the probability, I don't believe it, But at the same time, we're here to try and make sure that possibility is a zero. But yeah, I feel like we've been talking about this for ages now.
Considering the bill as it stands on its merits, I think Zander's point as representative's point pursuant to equity among student organizations remains salient, in particular referring to the fact that the similar measure has already been approved for affinity groups, something that is contingent on the university's admissions practices, which we do not have immediate influence over. With that said, the idea that if every student organization in the current funding tier were to max out their cap, that would put us in the red, that makes me less likely to want to vote down this bill and more likely to want to repeal the previous act that put forward the funding guidelines. That is to say, if the sponsor would entertain an amendment to include a separate clause that would prorate the current funding caps with coordination of the appropriate finance chair, I would be happy to work with you on that.
Kind of inquiry to Jessica. Are we allowed to repeal the funding? Like the resolution that we have? Like, is that, I don't actually know.
I have to look. I don't know. Anu is here, isn't he?
Yeah.
Do you know?
I do not know.
We've already approved the AIF
for the next 2 years, yeah.
To certain groups.
Yeah, it's already been done.
And I know with normal motions, yes.
The point is more rhetorical, as in this line of argumentation does not call into question the legitimacy of this sort of kind of equity among student organizations so much as more of a judgment of the way that we balance funding among tiers.
I guess as a point of follow-up to that, I would maybe also make the argument that potentially this could have been something noted in that resolution as well.
Yes.
Are there any like fields that don't have enough people actually in them to meet the like lowest tier level? Do we know that?
Our fields.
Okay.
we would actually literally go. My field is currently at the 2500. And we use that for like talks and whatever. And we would go literally to 500. And that funding that we would lose is going to basically new organizations. But we've had that funding for years. And it's like a part of our department culture is these talks that we help fund and bring speakers and create our community. So.
You'd lose this money if we do nothing, or
yeah, if we do nothing, we'd go down to $500
because we created the new membership requirements this year.
Okay, thank you.
Yes,
Solomon. Just adding on top of that, can we make can we say 40% of the students has to be members? That we will ease other groups to not take advantage of this groups to not take advantage of this by being exempted and having like very minimal students.
40% of what kind of
students? Like 40% of the, like, let's say you're a feminist, technically 20 graduate students all the time, grad academy here. If we say 40% of those has to be a member, then we could eliminate some other in groups that would take advantage of this new amendment, in which they could use funding while having only 5.
I wouldn't be opposed. But.
I think my only issue would be how do we like keep track of that as well? Because within campus groups, they don't specify necessarily like if you're like part. If, like it only says like you're a grad student or whatever. It doesn't specifically say like if you're like let's say for me, I'm a master's student in public health. It doesn't specifically say I'm MPH in campus groups. It just says I'm a graduate student. So if we're determining it based off of like the number of grad students within the term program, if at least 40% of said students go then becomes a member of your club, then you get funding. I think that's gonna be hard for campus groups to even reflect that because they just don't give that determination.
Point of inquiry. are we able to tell campus groups like what things to check? Like, do we have any control over what campus groups does? Kind of.
I'm going to let Jessica go because Jessica probably has the best answer to this, but things have been tenuous this year,
yeah,
is I guess what I will say.
Okay.
They want minimal requirements on their end for ease of
usage,
standardizing processes, and clicking buttons as fast as possible, is my understanding. Okay. Jessica, you say better words than me.
not in the moment, I don't. So campus groups is the platform. Campus activities is the office that manages campus groups and organizations on campus. And so your question, Xander, was
can we ask them, hey, can you check, for example, hey, can you check, like, are these grad students, like, in this department? Because that's publicly available, like, it's on department website.
We could try asking them. I think it would be correct for Anu to ask them. I also think you can look in. I don't get in campus groups much. I'm sorry. I think you can look in there and see people in an organization. Also, the finance commissioner, Anu, has more access than some of the rest of us. Maybe might be able to see it. I don't know. I'm not sure if you spent more time in there than I have.
Yeah, I can. I wrote that down. I can talk. Yeah, for it's not.
Okay. It's feasible. And then the other thing was, Michelle, were you asking if the GPSA can revoke funding? Is that what you asked?
Essentially, because there was a point brought up of potentially because if this is rooted in equity rather than I don't know the right language for it. Rather than finance, then should we instead go back and repeal the last finance measure? I don't know if that's possible or not. That was what that question was.
Okay.
Can we repeal the motion that set forward our next 2 years of finance?
Oh, no. You can't change the student activity fee. That's already been...
Yeah, that's the what I'm asking.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's
the answer is no to that.
Yeah.
Point of inquiry, that, or actually point of information, the student activities fee is related to the finance measure, but it doesn't say that we cannot change the caps necessarily that go for each, funding tier. Like, that could still be malleable because clubs have not received their disbursement, correct?
So if you're talking about the tiers,
it's all listed in the same motion slide.
You can change, the GPSA can change its funding guidelines. It's supposed to only be on a non...
Yeah, every 2 years.
This in a year.
Yeah.
So they really shouldn't be changed this often because what you're doing is changing the rules as these organizations are trying to follow your rules and then you keep changing them. So they really should sit and be amended when it's at a certain time. Don't quote me on the time. So
every
the
GPSA can change. Supposed to set the funds, and every off 2 years, we're supposed to change the guides. But that didn't happen because of the pandemic and other things. So this year, we got a pile up,
mm-hmm.
is what happened.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yes. I guess there was this one thing about checking whether the people who are enrolled on campus groups in a specific organization, if they belong to that field, I guess because there is a way to cross-verify, and I guess most of us can do that, but especially people who are on the organization board, because if a field group applies for field funding, then they have to provide this document,
mm-hmm.
which is an official document of who are enrolled. So it's not just the number of people that are whose profiles are there on each of the graduate pages, but it's like an official document that the university has produced. So it could also be exchange students or non-degree students for that academic year, and they would still count as affiliated with that field. And then you can check who are the members on the campus groups and if that aligns. If you have more people, because there could be others from different departments that might not necessarily be in that specific field, but they still have overlapping work, or they have somebody from a committee member from one of the other fields, so they are somehow pseudo-affiliated. But I guess there is a way of checking if the people who are on the campus groups in that specific group are affiliated with that field or not.
I guess my only thought there is where the labor falls, but that's not a problem in this moment. Yeah.
Just to kind of go on that, like, it seems like anything we do to really drill down and make sure no, absolutely nobody who doesn't deserve this funding gets this funding will involve a lot of box ticking for somebody and a lot of paperwork and a lot of extra verification. I feel like I've kind of changed my position on this and am willing to trust the graduate students of this university and say, just pass the thing. That's how I'm feeling.
I kind of liked the idea that was floated. Sorry, this is not at all related to that. I kind of like the idea floated that potentially rather than in line 24 stating campus group membership requirements for maintaining or moving tiers, we change it to maintaining or moving up one tier. I think you might have mentioned that.
I don't think I particularly.
No, I'm thinking, yeah. Sorry for your name. I'm terrible. Mm-hmm. Two grads.
Me, Akash.
Akash, that's it. Yeah, okay. I was thinking Akash might have floated that idea.
I think a couple of people have brought it up before to put a cap on how much a group that is exempted is able to move up beyond either where they are at currently or what their membership numbers would have them be at. So, for example, just if you would be at 500, you could only move up to 1500,
yeah.
Or if it's just couldn't go more than one above where you're currently at. If you're already at 2500, then up to 3500, I guess. But we could debate which one of those is preferred. Yeah.
Would this proposed cap also apply to affinity groups, or is it just solely for field groups?
This motion is solely
this
about
is field groups.
No, but if there were if the caps.
This okay. Language would only be on this motion.
Okay.
I would make an alternative equity argument for that, but we don't have to. Is the comments in the chat to this?
I don't think so. No. Good catch, so much.
Point of theory, I guess, would it be possible then to amend the language of Resolution 6 to incorporate that, or would we have to?
Yes, it would be a motion to amend. So I can do that. Motion to amend line 24. So instead of saying maintaining or moving one tier up.
Point of inquiry, we should inquiry or information. I'm not for sure. But we should define what moving up one means before we amend to before we amend with vague language.
I think it would need to be a tier off the membership numbers, like what they would be at now, how many up they can go from that, from what they would be at based on.
So my understanding of one funding tier up would mean you are evaluated, you are told which funding tier is your maximum, and then you're able to apply one up from that. A cop. Oh, sorry, all the names wrong. Can you tell me how you would feel about that?
Yeah, the amendment to raising it that way, moving up one from what you would be normally, that sounds good. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
My language of confusion is that, let's say that in year one, you were told that you're only able to be in tier one funding, which I think is the lowest, or is that tier zero? Is that thing?
We have a tier zero
now. Okay, so let's say that you're only eligible for tier zero in year one. And then that means that with this new amendment, you're eligible to apply for tier one funding and stuff. Then wouldn't that mean that in the next year when you apply for your tier one funding, because you're quote unquote eligible for that, because you're already in that, wouldn't you then be able to jump to tier two because it's what you're eligible for?
It'll still be based on we can make it be based on original membership numbers, like always, like one tier above.
I don't think based on membership. But then I don't think that language at the moment as it's would be a friend.
Yeah. Well,
clarify that.
Point of response to the comment, I suppose, apologies. I think that issue is still present in the language wording otherwise. Because if you, as a new field group, would join, you can move maintaining or moving between funding tiers. That is still vague. You could still move theoretically to the highest tier at the beginning anyway.
Right.
We should amend
one per year. You can only move up one tier per year.
Yeah. So then that should also be included as well if you want.
Now it's every 2 years. Point of clarification.
So does this mean that even if you're in tier like whatever four, that you would still be exempt and go to tier five just because you felt like it?
Yeah, if you are a field organization.
Mm-hmm. Under the modified link.
Yeah.
Interesting. But you would still have to hit all of the requirements. This is purely for membership.
Yeah.
Point of clarification on what the other requirements would be then?
The baseline requirements,
which you're
in the all in our FC guidelines document, you have to spend 90% of your budget for 2 years. You have to send someone to not 75% of GPSA meetings. You have to have someone on the finance commission, etc.
So if all those other factors and guidelines are still going to be in place, I don't necessarily see a need for there to be another cap on membership if the one thing that we're trying to help remedy is the fact that the membership amount is disproportionately affecting field groups.
Perfect. Great. Do we know how many groups this would actually apply to? We have like a set number on that.
We've had less than 10 groups apply for field funding in the last couple of years, but there are many that it could apply to if they wanted it to. This would be like for each department.
Well, so point of inquiry, if you don't mind interrupting, to follow up on that, do we have the numbers of how many organizations would be impacted if we removed the limits as was? I think we talked before about how many organizations would be increased or decreased tiers based on membership. I don't know if we actually have those.
So I'd also just like to note that all the tiers are different in the following year because of the changes made to the FC guidelines in this calendar year. So one-to-one tier assumptions are not the same anymore. Like tier one of our old system is not equivalent to tier one of our new system in money or requirements. And I shared all of that information, but I do not believe anyone put together those figures.
I vaguely remember you put together some things.
Ocean had some.
I had some things. I wasn't able to put in other things immediately and stuff. I believe a good amount of like the names and everything was also redacted.
Oh,
so it wasn't
redacted to the end.
Yeah. So in that case, I couldn't even find information as to like which groups are going to be affected in the first place, because I didn't really necessarily be able to see what's
It's just a number of X groups as opposed to this particular.
Yeah, I wasn't able to see who was a field group.
Mm.
I think that goes back to we don't have that data.
Yeah.
In the name of time, I will ask if anyone would like to propose a motion with this resolution, or if we would like to continue to table it or amend it. Yes.
Motion to amend the resolution, line 24, to read campus groups membership requirements for maintaining or moving up one level from their actual membership based GPSA funding tier.
Do we have a second for that motion?
Point of order. Does the sponsor take it as friendly?
Oh. Does a sponsor take it as friendly?
Sure, I'll take it as friendly.
Okay, then we don't have to, we can just add it in as a resolution, and we can just incorporate it if we want to put that to a vote now. And just, we won't have it written up right now, but that is what we will add it to. we'll add it to that. I can entertain a motion to call the question.
I move to the previous question on this resolution.
With the added amendment.
With the added amendment.
Is there a second to the motion?
Seconded.
All right, we will have a vote. Could all of the voting members that are in favor of this resolution please raise their placards and on Zoom give a green check mark? Did anyone on Zoom want to? Do we have any voting members?
David is a no.
Okay. So, would any, all of those who oppose now, please raise your hand.
Oh.
David opposed. And then anyone who would like to abstain? All right. And that is 20, which is the number of people that we had. All right. It looks like.
What I'd be trying, considering the counts. Didn't include Nicholas, but Nicholas is here now.
I think we were counting Kate.
Oh, we got another abstain. Or is that a?
Oh,
that's a no.
I don't see that. I mean,
the number. 15 to 21.
Yes.
Fine. Majority.
Okay, so the vote is 15 in favor, 2 opposed, 3 abstain. The resolution has passed. we will add the amendment and send it to President Pollack. Yes.
I just have one question, and I hope this doesn't screw everything up, but are we moving, if you're falling in tiers, are you moving to your highest possible tier? Like, if that question makes
sense. I think what we added as a friendly amendment was one space, one tier up from what you are now evaluated at with your membership with the new FC guidelines.
I guess as a point of information also, you can have members on your campus group you can be a field organization and have members of your campus group organization or not within your field if they attend your events. I would recommend that.
All right. In favor of time, we have passed this resolution. Great job, everybody. We will now move on. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about, Michelle, with the UA response to the interim expressive activity policy?
I would love to hear people's thoughts. And I'm going to pull up my computer so I can type things. But if you want to explicitly not move forward on the resolution, please also make that noted. Because I want to be able to hear comments while also respecting people's desire frame. So are there any questions on the interim expressive activity policy as it stands? And are there any thoughts about the way this is affecting our communities? It can include the divestment information as well, and whether or not you feel it's appropriate to be looped into one, given that these things are both independent yet interconnected in this current moment.
As much as the topics are interconnected with each other, I believe it makes more sense for them to be separate resolutions because of both of them having different impacts overall. And generally speaking, just to make things a lot cleaner, on like what is it that we agree and disagree on how we vote and stuff, having them separate makes the most sense for efficiency's sake.
I'm paying attention. I'm just typing.
Yeah,
is the so the two things that we're talking about are whether we join the joint committee. No, the joint committee is something different, right?
Joint committee will be a motion of its own.
Okay.
This is more, Martha has specifically requested from the UA a response on this policy. So we have to give her a response. And then what would you like to be the response from graduate students in that? And with that all being said, the fact that the UA has already decided to reject the policy as it stands.
Yeah. Are we able to ask for a quick straw poll on people's perspective on the policy itself? Just to get a better gauge of like how we have this conversation?
Yeah, Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Motion to stroppel. What do I have to do for that?
Well, stroppel is like an informal kind of thing.
Yeah.
Not necessarily needed for a motion.
Okay. If you don't know what this policy is at all, raise your hand. Okay. Fair amount of the room. If you are in favor of this policy, raise your hand. If you are against this policy, raise your hand. Okay. So it seems like we have people who don't know and people who are not explicitly for this policy. It's the general consensus.
Oh. We only have like 7 minutes. Do we want to extend the meeting or do we want to have people email you?
Is there any?
I move to extend the meeting by 10 minutes for us to end at 6:40 p.m.
Unanimously.
I mean, if no one objects, I would ask for unanimous approval.
Do we have a second? Okay. Is there any objections to extending the meeting by 10 minutes? Great.
Team Board, can I ask you for a quick explanation of how this policy came about and why it came about in the form that it did? And by that, I mean there was no university assembly, either like UA itself or any other individual constituency that was told and requested for like feedback on this policy. So it was just kind of dropped and it wasn't so democratic.
Okay, I'm happy to address the question, but please understand this is from my perspective, and is only my truth.
Yeah,
it's not necessarily exactly what is accurate, but I'll do my best. So this policy is one that when our new, well, she's not new anymore, general counsel came on board, and she was trying to find our various policies on various. Just different principles on what you do if someone behaves in a way that we don't like. And, you know, but anyway, she found these policies all over campus. That's all true. And so she started working on just putting things together. She and her team quite some time ago. Then I believe that you're aware, this is public information, that the university is subject to an Office of Civil Rights investigation right now. As a part of that Office of Civil Rights investigation, we have to be able to show that we have policies and procedures in place that deal with the kinds of behaviors that we really don't want to allow to happen on campus without some sort of consequence. And so what she'd been working on just kind of came together pretty quickly. And it was disseminated to a variety of different groups. I have no idea that full range or comment, and then was released as an interim expressive activity policy. That's, from my perspective, what happened. My opinion on this matter is that it is, especially after, I think there was sincere surprise and shock at the reaction to this policy. I really don't think they thought it was going to be that
hot
and poorly accepted. I think that's honestly true. And they are sincerely asking for your input and your help now. They're going to be putting together a team to recraft and rebuild it. I mean, it didn't go well, people. And so the point is now to try to repair it. But also, now this is also an opinion, and I'll get to you in a moment, Latian. This is an opinion, and that is that I think protest is extremely important. I think speaking your truth and your mind is extremely important. And it's really, really important to understand what those boundaries are. And if your intent, for example, is to be arrested or to move beyond those boundaries so that you make a point, you better know what those boundaries are, right? At least I think so. And so it's a point of argument, right? But if that's your goal, to move beyond the boundaries so that you make a point, you have to know what they are. So help us establish the boundaries. It's so important we get it right. And it needs to be something with community effort to try to achieve that end. And so I so appreciate your talking about this. And I so appreciate your willingness to speak up in a way that's helpful to our team. So we'll see.
So I think one of the biggest reasons why I think that the policy overall has gotten so much bad press and stuff, low-key is because of the bad timing of like when it was released and sent out. Obviously, like being like released in the middle of during a really hot current event already gives the guise that the university is trying to actively limit free speech while also pioneering quote unquote free speech. So I think it's just one huge part of it is just optics overall and why it's doing so badly and with such greater scrutiny. But also, in generally speaking, I do see where the administration and the authors are coming with, like, establishing those boundaries and stuff. It's just not really translating, unfortunately, because there's words and language that makes it a little bit confusing, conflicting and stuff. I can name a few things, like, for example, when it comes to, like, postering on campus, you can do it indoors in like some certain areas, but you're exclusively restricted from postering at all outside. And you can't do it on lampposts, can't do it on trees, can't do it on buildings. So like, where can you really do that? It seems like you're limiting a lot of people overall. And it's not even just limiting for like just posters. It can be being something as small as like, if you lost your dog, you technically can't put up a poster of your lost dog based on the policies that's being enforced. Then of course, there's people talking about the protests and how having these guidelines that you must register or like try to explain or just like let the administration know that like, hey, we're having these protests and stuff makes it feel like that we're being policed a bit as well, when the whole idea of social activism and political activism, community organizing, isn't not necessarily to have it registered and then promote like, hey, come to this fun event. It's more of just like, we're here, we're frustrated and everything and stuff. So there's, of course, more conversations to have, but I think that's like a few of the main points.
Beautifully stated. And I completely concur that this happened in the absolute perfect storm of events, not only globally, but locally. Very unfortunate. And the process through which it happened was imperfect. And the thing is, sometimes you only see those things in hindsight. And this is clearly one of those situations. And so I do appreciate so much those of you who are willing to help.
I did just have a question about, so you talked about like the new lawyer who came in and was working on civil rights policies. So what was this policy supposed to, like what civil rights was this policy supposed to protect?
Title VI. Yes, Title VI.
Okay, and what is Title VI? Sorry.
So that is, and I will be able to hit it only superficially. Mm-hmm. Not being a lawyer, molecular microbiologist. So, you know, full disclosure here. And so Title VI is about discrimination, racism, and that sort of behavior that we find unacceptable on campus, and appropriate consequences for behavior that is perceived.
Also, just
having
their verbal policies that scatters throughout the university. So a part of this one was they said that they were just unifying these policies. That being said, maybe we all should have taken a step back and looked it up earlier. We didn't. Who could have known?
Just not
so really. The policies that they made, these are in favor of such kind of?
So I can link you the policy itself, but essentially it gives restrictions on protesting. It also, for personal feelings around this policy, I think it's still kind of confusing on what a protest is defined by this. Is like a block party a protest? Is having ice cream on the porch with your department a protest? In the way that this is defined, it's not explicitly clear. If you use amplified noise, then that answer is yes. And that is a little confusing, right? Because like, does my Bose speaker count as that? When I'm having ice cream with my left.
There's a lot of need for clarification.
Yeah,
absolutely right.
And also, how do we define free speech and what is the limit to it? Do we have that?
No. I think that's what this policy aims to sort of get at, is define that line.
Okay, in lieu of time, if you have any further thoughts on this interim expressive activity policy, please email Michelle.
MMH265. M like M&Ms. MMH.
And we do highly recommend anyone who hasn't read the policy to read it over, because it will eventually, when we have the full policy, have an impact on many groups and activities on campus.
And if you want to see the UA response, I can share the motion with anyone. And you're more than welcome to add whereas clauses or comment on other people's comments.
Okay, we will quickly move on to reports of the officers and committee updates, starting with the executive committee. I'm just going to say about elections.
Yeah, and transit.
Okay, we have elections coming up. Nominations will open on April 8th and go until the 22nd. There'll be QR codes and all of our posters. We're having a Big Red Barn TGIF takeover on the 12th of April. We're going to be like getting out the word that we're having elections, tell people about the roles. But please nominate yourself and or others for some of the committee chair positions, the executive chair positions, as well as voting member positions. We do vote on those. We are, you know, often filling them late in the fall, but we vote on them now. So if you have people in your field that you think would be good voting members, nominate them. And then voting will be the week after it closes, from the 24th to the 1st. But we have very low voter turnout, guys. I think I was elected with 4 or 8% of the student population, and I was running against no one else. So please just talk to your departments. We want to get as much student engagement and feedback as we can. And we will have posters and stuff getting out to you all soon. You can put them up in your buildings, but I just wanted to give you guys a heads up. What did you want to say about transit?
Oh, I am working with, I'm sorry for your name, so I'm too. On transit, and this we're going to bring up at the UA level because it's a term of our employment, so it's not brought at the GPSA level. So we're looking to make an potentially ad hoc or permanent committee of people from postdoc, staff, faculty, employees. Did I name all of that already? Everyone, essentially. So potentially have like a transit advisory board. Obviously, we'll see how much power that board gets. But I think our request would be that we have the ability to speak to parking services and TCAT and campus to campus and other pertinent transit authorities, and potentially also explicitly for parking services have some level of like collaboration when policies are changed.
Yeah. Okay, one final thing from executive committee. The graduate school is looking to hire a new graduate student life advisor. This previously was Angela Yonturno. I don't know if any of you interacted with her, but this is a really important position within the graduate school. They interact with a lot of graduate professional students, and they're looking for someone from GPSA to be on the search committee to review all of the applicants and to help narrow down the pool to find this new person that many, many people in our constituency will interact with. So if anyone is interested in being on a search committee, please come and talk to me after the end of the meeting. Okay, operations, Annika is not here. Appropriations, David.
Wait, we have left. You're the other member of the committee, right?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Oh, enjoy.
We're finishing up edits to the bylaws, reflecting on some of our conversations that we've had here in the meetings and based on feedback from the parliamentary procedures presentation. We're actually planning a meeting in the next couple of weeks to actually kind of come bring everything back together. We've already divvied up and done the independent section. So progress moved on that.
Yeah, we're not necessarily going to finish with like an amendment this semester, but we're gonna set it up so that it could potentially happen in the following semester.
Appropriations, David left. Communications?
Lots of election stuff. I just finished up the posters. There's 5 different ones. We're going to make them pretty big. It's going to be 15 each. So look out for those. There's also a QR code on all the posters for the nomination form. So keep an eye out for that. That'll be in the 8th. We put an ad in BRB. You guys saw that newsletter about our GPA takeover that's coming up. So attend that if you're interested, and then having one or more positions. As always, like, communicate, send me stuff. Love to put them in.
Finance. Anu left, I believe. Student advocacy. Not here. DISC.
We will be hosting a mixer event, which will be mostly a town hall format on the 17th. We'll give more details in the newsletter as well as circulate poster in the next meeting. So that's one thing. And the second, we'll be also participating in the Cornell Out of Darkness work happening on April 14th. We will also be taking some of the election posters to circulate for that.
Perfect. Programming. I don't think Katie is here, but the gala is happening. The next ticket drop, I believe, is tomorrow.
It's April 9th.
April 9th?
April 9th.
Is the next ticket drop?
Yes.
There's a one on the 26th, so there was supposed to be.
I thought we passed March 26th. Yeah, March 26th and April 9th.
So the next ticket drop is tomorrow at 11 a.m. Tickets are selling out very fast, so recommend. The link is in the communique that we sent out, so you can go back to that and do that. Graduate school.
Just two quick things. In addition to the position that we're filling or aiming to fill in graduate student life and support, we did just fill a position in the fellowship's office, which will help speed up our practices, our business practices, and I'm delighted to announce that. And now, I would like to invite you to come join me for trivia night at the Big Red Barn. I'm guest hosting tomorrow night, so I hope to see you there.
All right. Now we're in the open forum. Anything anyone wants to say before we adjourn? All right. I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Do we have a second? All right. Thanks, everybody. Good meeting. See you in 2 weeks. Have a good spring break.